So the image you were looking at was an image from the temple of Seti. And it's an image, obviously, of a temple colonnade and leading into a golden image, which you couldn't quite see. Deliberately chosen to be not very clear. The chant is from the Papyrus of Ani, A-N-I. And it's, although it's found in lots of places, it's, so ba is the soul. Pu Neta means to be like a god, to be like one of the Neteru. Ba Pu Neta means my soul is like the gods. Ba Pu He means my soul exists for millions of years, which means my soul is eternal. So putting together, you have Bapu Netta, Bapu He, which is the sense of my soul is at one with the gods, my soul is eternal. So it's and obviously, you know, I have no idea how the Egyptians actually chanted it, but the we don't have any examples of Egyptian music, and in a sense, even our pronunciations are a reconstruction. But it's got a powerful little chant. What was the effect of chanting it? What was it like for you?
I find it opened up the heart and the throat area.
Yeah. Yeah, it is quite hearty. It does that. And also, you're right, the throat. It is something about the expressiveness and the sense of that, really.
Well, I have it in the belly, too, actually.
Yeah, good. Good.
The beat was very visceral. I was almost feeling sick, actually. It was really like you just each step towards that doorway. And
yeah.
And what came to me is when you can see the doorway, it's your direction is kind of inevitable. You just aim for the door. It's when you can't see it that it's difficult.
No, that's of course is right. I mean, and it's an interesting image, isn't it? Because the image directs you. You've got this temple colonnade and this sense of the golden image, you know, which in a sense is the image of the golden nature of your own soul, I suppose, really.
There's nowhere else to go, is there? It's just when you can see it.
When you can see it, it's true. Yeah, that's true. Mm.
It felt like a birth chant to me, but also like a funeral chant, both at the same time.
Yeah, sure.
And that sort of forward, kind of circly forward thing.
Yeah.
And I found that towards, I guess, the last half of the chanting, I was just sort of making a low growling noise alongside you. I was glad I was muted, but that's what I needed to do, so I just went with it.
Yeah, sure, yeah. What was that like, the growling noise? What did it give you? What was the feeling of quality?
Like a cow.
Yeah.
But it felt very necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But it reminded me of, you know, the kinds of sounds you need to make in childbirth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I suppose I just, you know, just allowed my body.
Yeah, so it brought you deep down into the body as you did that.
Mm.
Yeah, right, good.
Yeah.
I agree with Rob. I found the drumming visceral and a little disturbing at first. Mm. I found the chant not easy to sing. It was in my throat, and then when it went up to my head, it was much easier, and I could relax more into it. But it did make the following meditation very easy to fall into, very easy.
Mm.
So it was. Obviously had an effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, chanting is always very good for that. I think one of the difficulties of doing this all over Zoom is we're not able to get the full effect of chanting. You know, if we were chanting this together, you know, it would be that much more powerful. And chant is always such a great entry place between inside and outside, I think. Because I think you're right, Ben, as you do that, it kind of opens you into that deeper kind of territory. So then as you drop into that, the passage is a lot easier. Because your energy has been engaged somewhere in that act of moving inwards.
I found it quite lifting and liberating, because I'd been in a lot of grief and heavy, strong energy before, and So in the chant, I felt like, sort of coming out of this energy.
Yeah, so good. Nice. That sounds good for you.
I had a similar feeling to that, and that I have been feeling for most of this last month quite flat and resistant to coming out, but doing the chant and seeing that glow of the light,
yes, that's nice.
I really felt the pull in the opposite, or the push, the wanting to go out, and a sort of excitement and a letting go of all the reservations that I have, not all the reservations I have about, I don't understand this, I don't know what I'm doing, I can't do it anyway, I've learned nothing in this last 2 years.
Yes, it's better. And that's really great, Jenny. That's great. Oh, dear, those terrible old voices we all carry. Oh, dear. I know. It's great.
I love that sense of it. Yeah, I really resonate with that. What you were saying, Jenny, the kind of excitement, and there was like an anticipation. I don't know, there's something kind of switched on in me when we started doing the chant. And actually, I loved being muted, because I did enjoy the just kind of weaving around and playing.
Yeah.
So there was something very playful in it for me. And with the drum, there was a sense of anticipation. I kind of have a sense of going, oh my God, we're our number 12 and I need to do this all again, because I haven't got anything, you know, from it, and I don't know what I'm doing and all of that. But it was just going, oh well, I'm here, I'm sitting here in this place, and I've got this star,
yeah,
and what a great place to be. So I loved the meditation afterwards, loved it. So it was something about, yeah, almost like the chant quietened the mind in my mind.
Yeah, way. That's part of what's intended to do, really. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Mm. Thank you.
Okay.
What this whole weekend's doing for me, today has done, is waking up feelings that are held under. It's waking up feelings that are there that are harder to feel. So that's it's making things alive.
That's nice. Good. I'm glad.
Rather than that sort of, I don't know, numbed out sort of place. So I suppose there's life in that, isn't there? That's life.
No, definitely. And I think that, you know, there's so much about, you know, the whole Egyptian thing is about life. It's about celebrating life and awakening life. You know, that there's this great phrase they have for dead people: say their name that they may live. And there's something about that quality of life, right? That is a quality of the Nile. It's the irrigation of the Nile. It's the sort of the sort of fertility of life, right? So feeling as opposed to numbing, trusting and moving as opposed to sitting in a collapsed heap. It's that fundamental kind of thrust you get in Egyptian tradition. It's about the celebration of life somewhere.
The relief of feeling what hurts.
Yes, exactly that, right? So as opposed to the suppression of numbness. So the sharpness, the pain, it's awful, and it's alive in its awfulness, alive in its sharpness. It's that, not dead.
Yeah. And it's sort of waking that up for me, I guess.
Yeah, no, I can hear the trouble. Yeah.
Needs more awakening, but it's, yeah.
Yeah, great.
And it reveals deeper truths, actually.
Yeah, for sure it does, yeah.
So I felt when you translated the chant, you were saying that my soul is like the gods, my soul is eternal, and I felt so uplifted by that, because it felt like, oh, I go on.
Yes, that's right.
That feeling very positive about that, rather than the opposite.
And, yeah.
An opening to life in a way, or moving.
Thank you, Andy. That's lovely. No, that's exactly it. In a way, that's that celebration, that lifting up. It's important. Maybe particularly at the moment when life is very chaotic and very difficult, and there has been a lot of pushing down, I suppose. So there's something about that energy of rising, and that's the kind of energy that that's around the image of Osiris, because it's like the barley shoots coming up, you know, the sort of the irrepressible life of spring somewhere, when the sort of when the grain that's going to feed you, that's going to sustain you, comes as this amazing green shoots. They had this phenomenal custom in Egypt, where they, around about this time of year, where they would have these little Osiris-shaped molds that they'd fill with earth and sow with barley, and they had lots of little holes in them. So you'd get this Osiris, this green, literal green man of Osiris, that would be sprouting with barley shoots. It's a really lovely kind of custom.
There's also a lot of poignancy, because there's death too.
Both. No, that's it, isn't it?
The other just come up.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. It's both. Anyway, that's the sense of life and death, pain and expectation, you know, loss and gain. You know, it's the opposites together.
This whole deadening thing really interests me, this idea of parts of oneself becoming numb and deadened. Yeah. And probably we can all imagine a major trauma where we feel that's happened. Mm. And then we gradually come back to life. But it's also incremental, isn't it? So many tiny things. Mm. That just gradually eat away at that open-hearted engagement with life. All through our lives.
No, I think that's right. I think, and that's almost more, I mean, obviously the big things are difficult, but they're, in some ways, at least they're known. I think the more corrosive thing is the many little disappointments, or the thousand cuts, in a sense, that gradually start to just close yourself down, close your confidence down, close your heart down. I think that, you know, that's it's that sense of the ground being ground down. It's that kind of feeling in some ways. Mm. You know, it's. Mm. And of course, you know, the ancient Egyptians had that just as much as us, but that's why a lot of their prayers, a lot of their practices are about countering that or working with that somewhere. You know, the middle Egyptian poem of the man communing with his bar soul is absolutely all about that. It's all about that kind of, I don't want to live anymore, I'm despairing, and this life and death dialogue that he and his soul have together, where he's trying to persuade his soul that it's right for him to kill himself. And then, that interesting thing you get, the accommodation they get, where he agrees that he will live, but he will long for death and he will live. So that's the coming together of the kind of those opposites and the sort of and then that beautiful image of the soul saying, and then I will join with you together. I will make my nest in your heart, because as you join the opposites in this way, you know, and you know, so it's so interesting. I mean, I think what always interests me about some of the, you know, partly studying Egyptian things is difficult. They're quite alien, and often we only partly understand. But there's also something oddly contemporary about them as well, because they're very directly addressing the human situation, really. And in particular, because
What I remember last time, I can't remember you. Recited some of this poem about the man his bar soul. What I remember from that is how contemporary it was, how resentful, adolescent, sort of drama queeny.
Oh, totally, totally.
It was. You know what I mean? Yeah. I just think we can all see ourselves in that person, can't we?
No, that's the brilliant. That's sort of the brilliance of it in some ways. That acting out kind of, you know, that stamping your feet and crossing your arms and kind of, you know, it was just that's the magic of it somewhere.
Another thing when you're a place of longing for death, the death is also the shut down place. It's not necessarily a literal death, of course. It's the part of us that gets sucked into the shut down place because it's preferable to feeling, isn't it?
No, it is. And the interesting thing about the soul of the bar soul poem is saying that it's tied to actively long for that. Right, so to actively long for that, because while you're aware that you're longing for death, you're not numbed. when you're numbed, you just shut down. You don't even need, you know, you're just closed. So that place where I'm actively feeling I want to die and I hate this, and I hate this world, when you're present with that, there's a life energy in that. You see what I mean? Because you're with it. Like when you're really numbed, you just sit there, kind of, and have another drink, you know, and it's that kind of real shutdown. But so in that poem, what he's saying is, well, if you're going to have that feeling, well, then actively long for death, but do not kill yourself. And because it's by the active engagement with the part of us that doesn't want to live, the part that's sad or resentful or have had enough. The odd paradox is that it's like you were saying, as you engage with that, it's sharp, it's painful, but you're alive in it. You know, because the long
engagement is the moment of feeling, and
yeah,
engagement is the moment.
It is the moment of feeling, because even if you know you want to die, but in that odd, that's the paradox of this, right? Because you know that, because you feel that, you're actually quite alive in that moment. Mm. You know, it's complex, really, but it's.
I'm having a little bit of trouble making that leap, because I know I get the place of feeling, but seeing that as.
So if you're feeling, right, let's take this place where you feel like I want to die, I'm fed up, I hate my life, right? We just take that idea. Now you can do, I hate my life, and then you can just shut off. Now if instead of that, you stay present to that feeling of hating your life. Feeling the pain inside that, feeling the grief in that, even feeling the resentment and the rage in that. Then there's a lot of life in that, because you're present with it, you're in it. You're not collapsed in it, you're not defeated by it, you're in it. You're letting it affect your life. And in that, paradoxically, therefore, you're very alive in that moment, while longing for death. You know, that's and that's the sort of, in a way, the thing that the Bar Soul is pointing at. Well, be present with that, be with that, but because you're like that, you draw the qualities of the soul to you, because you're really aware in the moment.
It's a question of control, though, isn't it? Because those feelings are just so overwhelming.
Yeah, sure.
That one can just, I don't know, be consumed by them.
No, that's right. And of course, that's the whole point of having that kind of larger sense of holding, larger sense of presence that can hold that and not be overwhelmed. Because you're right, once you're overwhelmed, you lose it, and you shut down, or you kill yourself, or you get carried away by it. So, a lot of the work of the Book of Gates is developing this capacity to work with, to hold. So all that stuff about ropes and boundaries and unbinding is about the capacity to hold things and to contain things so that they become manageable and workable with, in a way.
Something about the opposites, what you were saying, especially around Seti. I feel kind of quite exhausted, quite sick, quite nauseous and headachy. I'm kind of feeling like I shouldn't be feeling like this in the last hour, but actually it feels pretty good that I can both be alive and have that kind of sense of, yeah, I'm sitting on the snake with my star, and it's not all happy,
no,
big flowers blooming. I can actually be in the centre of life and feel quite sick.
No, but that's the point, that you are sitting on the snake, right? The snake's an alive presence. It's not a plastic snake. It's a real snake. Right, so you're sitting in the middle of your life. You're sitting with what is really there. Now, that's a problem with these images. Any religious image, it can turn into a plaster static image, into an idol. So I should be now the happy initiate, you know, who's going to be radiant like the sun. Whereas actually, it doesn't matter. Whatever you do, you're sitting on the snake. You're sitting holding your star. And actually the important thing is to be present with what, you know, it's like a real snake you're sitting on. So it's, what's your snake? Maybe your snake's happy, maybe your snake's pissed off, maybe she's coiled up in the corner and wants to tell the world to fuck off. And then, yes, fine, you're present in that, you're in that, with that. That's what it means to sunrise.
What he expected this weekend that it's going to be easy.
Yeah, well, it's manifestation, it's emergence, right? The thing about emergence is we emerge as we are into the world as it is.
Yeah.
We emerge as we are into the world as it is. That's the key thing in some ways.
That's
yes?
Real.
Yeah. So when I imagine that image that I find so evocative,
yeah,
I actually put my hands in the position of it, which I found very powerful.
No, that's very powerful, yeah.
Totally. And I realised that the right hand is down, presumably maintaining a relationship with the snake.
Exactly so, yeah, totally that.
Which is maintaining the relationship with life as it is,
yes,
while the other hand is holding all the possibilities.
Yes, that's right, exactly. Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, actually, you raise a really interesting question, actually, because a lot of the, when you used to look at Egyptian art images, they're often the postures. If you let your body assume some of the postures sometimes, you get a really interesting sense of what is meant by the image. I remember once being in a tomb in one of the I think it was in the Queens Valley. There was a young American guy who was laughing, you know, joking around a bit, and he was making the offering posture. And I shocked him a bit because I said, "You better be careful. Well, what are you offering? You're making the offering posture. That's a real gesture, you know. And actually, if you're going to make that offering, you need to be careful about what you're intending to offer, because actually, that's a genuine embodiment of an image." So it's worth sometimes looking at some of these images and just like you were doing, Penny, take the posture, the body posture of the image, and then feel into what happens as you do that. It's quite powerful very often.
And that, are we kind of like a bridge in a way? And like,
yes,
feels to me like I'm holding,
yes,
like the duality and experiencing like deep grief,
yeah,
but also able to feel the opposite, and it's somehow being...
Yeah, well, that's when you're being the bridge. You're being almost the alchemical vessel that can hold both of those possibilities. So we're not denying either possibility, right? But by holding both, you're acting as the bridge, and that's the alchemy then that connects those two opposites. And so out of that, a third energy arises, which is the in a very simple way we could say the ability to find joy even while there is sorrow and grief. So that grief doesn't cancel out joy, so that joy doesn't cancel out grief. And so we are, in that sense, more deeply embodied in the world and more deeply able to help other people find, if they're in grief, find joy, or if they're in joy, not to disconnect from the painful aspects of life. So that's the kind of, that's the magic of, or bridging, really, bridging the opposites in that way.
Are we back to the pyramid, the three points? So.
Yeah.
Holding birth, and then third can come.
Absolutely, absolutely that, yeah.
So we become art too in this.
Yeah. No, we do, and the whole point of art really is the balance between opposites. It's finding the balance point that enables the energy of life to find its way without splitting, and that's the pivotal thing. Because the big problem of human life is that we constantly split and we constantly demonize, and that's where the alchemical work is, the bringing back together of all of that somewhere.
One thought that keeps coming up, so I'm going to share it because it came up in one of our discussions just briefly as well.
Yeah.
Is that there's something I feel I want to honour Seti. It's almost like I find his countenance very easy to look at, you know, the mummy, but it also feels wrong because he shouldn't be... exposed. And I mean, I get this all the time when I've gone to the British Museum and things like that. I get this awful sort of sadness and anger that these are not where they're supposed to be, and they're all exposed and feels like an imposition on them. And so I don't really know how this is relevant to what we've been doing today, except that we have that image of Seti and it keeps coming to me, where I sort of feel like I want to communicate with him in some way to say, yeah, I'm sorry that we're that I'm looking at you, but thank you for letting me.
Yeah, it does make sense, and of course it's complex, and it's always, it's so of course complicated, isn't it? Because so there's something about, I mean, actually, the face of Seti I think is very beautiful. It's got a real sense of serenity and beauty, and it's lovely. And you're right, of course, that actually that no one was supposed to look. You know, once you're in the tomb, you're supposed to, you know, stay in the tomb, and the house of eternity holds you forever. And you know, poor old Seti's tomb was despoiled, and about all his grave goods taken out in ancient Egyptian times, you know, so his and actually, I mean, he was one of the mummies in the Deir al-Bahri cache of mummies, because they were the high, because the high priests of Amun at a certain point took all the king's mummies and a lot of the queen's mummies and put them in a protected cache, because they could no longer they were no longer safe. So there's a that sense of the, you know, that that containment having been broken, and the you know, and the, but I think one of the things I found interesting, that because I think there is something about that, but there's also something about the mummies are very treasured, because this, I don't know if anybody saw the parade of the golden mummies. Anybody see that?
I saw photos. It looked a bit naff.
Yeah, it was brilliant. I mean, of course, it was naff. It was totally naff. It was totally over the top, right? It was totally Egyptian in the grandiosity. And the thing that I liked about it is that each of the mummies, they had their own golden car, and they had this extraordinary kind of concert where the Egyptian, famous Egyptian singers were singing ancient Egyptian chants to Isis, and it, at one level it struck me as very Egyptian, even in the ancient Egyptian sense, because the ancient Egyptians used to love huge kind of processions, and you know, and it was like a modern version of it. So there is a sense both of, again, we're with opposites, both of despoiling something, and both something that should have, oh my God, should we be looking at this? And at the same time, this being treasured. Mm. You know,
and they were named, weren't they?
No, absolutely, each one.
Every car was named,
absolutely. No, totally.
Well, the number plate.
Yeah, no, they did. Each one had their own number plate, so they were, you know, and then you have this hundreds of people with the bowls of light, and you know, it's very Hollywood, right? So it's really kind of Hollywood Egypt. But of course, in a certain sense, what is being treasured there is that ancient tradition. Are these, the fact that these are very significant, you know, the president of the republic stands and salutes the mummies as they go past, you know, and kind of, and it is whatever it is politically, and it's honoring something, you know. And obviously it's of course about the Egyptian tourist trade and the opening of the Grand Egyptian Museum, and I'm desperate for cash for tourist money. And at the same, so it's both, right? We're again with this complicated dualities of life somewhere.
It would be very nice to think in our country there is a similar honour paid to anything ancient, you know, being seen of worth, you know. Sure. I can't think of any comparison.
No. If we think of the peat bog figures in the British Museum, if they were being moved, there's no way there'd be some enormous procession. It would all happen surreptitiously. And yeah, in a way, there's something sad about that, isn't there? So there's something, you know, kind of
commodifying about it.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
We get false idols, don't we? A bit Churchill, or it could be Genghis Khan or something like that. You know, it's a big
yes, I mean, that's right. Well, our current one, of course, would be Prince Philip, I suppose, you know, who kind of, know, who's, of course, I suppose, well, no doubt buried by now, but that's the sort of thing that happens. So there's something, so that can happen. We can, the royal family becomes a version of that, but some of the deeper images of our culture. And in a way, I think that the peat man is a really good example of that, because he clearly was a sacred priestly figure, dying the threefold death, for whatever reason we don't know. But this is he's in a way the equivalent, I suppose, the Celtic equivalent of a pharaoh being a kind of a sacred figure that's interred into the land, but of course. Whereas in ancient Egypt, I suppose, at least people know about the pharaohs. Apart from those of us who are interested in this subject, Lindoman is a completely unknown figure.
Yeah.
You know, and it's and I think, you know, there's something interesting really, and about, if we look at Egyptian tradition, and then we look at British tradition, the details, of course, are very different cultures. But the same idea of the sacred ones who are buried inside the land and who act as a source of blessing exists all over the world. And, you know, we have our own versions of that, you know, you know, and the same, and of course, we have the same issues about people, you know, going into barrows and digging up and stealing the treasures, just like it's happened to the pharaohs. So it's a sort of, you know, we're looking at this in a very particular culture, but of course, it also exists here, you know,
and it's dry in Egypt. They don't have the damp to contend with.
They
had writing and they had preservation, didn't they?
That's right, and that's one of the big differences, of course. So there is this kind of enormous kind of literature, but but interestingly, sometimes when you look at some of the ancient Egyptian writings and you look at, okay, admittedly much later Celtic writings, you see, for example, if you think of the tale of the man and his bar soul, and you look at the dialogue of the two sages. Now, of course, they're completely different in context, but the same issue is being looked at, the issue of the necessity of bringing opposites together. You know, so in the end of the dialogue of the man and his bar soul, the bringing together of the longing for death and being alive is brought together. And in the dialogue of the two sages, the successful bard is the one who can embody, as well as the light, embody the destructive energies of life.
Yeah.
So the same point is being made in different ways, and the remnants of Celtic liturgy or Celtic images that we have in stories and songs, and certainly also in folk song, even though that's a much later thing, you can find the same kind of patterns that you will find in ancient Egyptian tradition. Not because everything is descended from ancient Egypt, which is one theory, but because both are addressing fundamental aspects of human nature and culture.
Yeah.
And would Seti have been like happy that we're reading the Book of Gates?
Oh, I believe so. Yes, totally.
And why did he put it in the sarcophagus and surround him in it? And did he not want to preserve it so that we would read it, so therefore he had to be found?
Well, in a way, that's one of the interesting questions, isn't it, right? Because in a certain sense, this was somebody who was intent at preserving something, ensuring that it continues, and he did that in a very particular kind of a way. And obviously we're never going to know exactly, but the fact that he did had this remarkable artifact created that actually couldn't be stolen. I mean, he'd have known that things got stolen out of tombs, because it had been happening long before Seti's time. It was a known problem. That's why they had guards and things. So one of the things he did do, so whatever it meant for him personally to be, and I'm sure it had deep personal meaning, wanting to be wrapped in the Book of Gates, but he was also creating an artifact that was so enormous that it couldn't be stolen. It would just sit there. What he couldn't have known about, of course, is the enormous technology of the 18th, of the early 19th century that could bloody well steal it, and then
colonials
came along. You know, did
bloody Belzoni.
It had lasted thousands of years before that. Before he not only took, well, the thing that pissed me off of that, he actually broke it in the process. Imbecile. Anyway, but somewhere he'd created an artifact that was going to survive and was going to point to that. Similarly, in the passage in the Osirian. He created something in stone that would persist, and even on the walls of the tomb. Suddenly, because this was never put on the walls of the tomb before the Akhenaten period ended. So they were somewhere inscribing something in stone, and their idea about putting something into creating an image was that the image has its own life. So by inscribing it in stone, it would continue to exist. It would continue to affect the world, whether somebody saw it or not. So at one level, I feel pretty convinced that he would be very pleased that we were looking at his book, because that was his intention, to preserve something that he in his lifetime watched being destroyed, and the threat of it being destroyed, because it would have existed only in papyrus form before Horem Heb and Ramses I and he started to inscribe it in stone, because it was pretty much a secret teaching and could then have vanished out of the world together. So I suspect he'd have been really kind of pleased about it. And if we believe Om Seti, who believed that she was in communication with him, that he was very interested in this revival of his spirit, was very interested in this revival of Egyptian tradition. So he'd have been very pleased with this. And in that sense, I think it's important to remember that therefore he is dead and he lives. So you could ask him, is he pleased, and find out what his answer is. So just about the end of our time for today. Is anybody left with anything burning they need to say or want before we close up and then come back tomorrow?
Any preparation, Ian?
Eh?
For tomorrow?
No preparation needed. You've done all the preparation. It's all done. It's all good. So however you are is fine. You're doing it fine. And obviously the things to think about in terms of, you know, because we have now another 3 days left together. Just go back over anything and just see if there's any questions you want to ask or things that you're not clear about, or, you know, from any point of the course, really. I mean, in the tomorrow we're going to look particularly at this moment of sunrise and what happens in that. And the key point about that, and why you don't have to do any preparation, is that the act of sunrise is an act of relaxation and being lifted up by the energies of the depth. You don't have to do anything. You surrender into the process of emergence. So
Ian.
Yes.
Sorry, it's not really a question, but a kind of a something about the millions of years and the solar bark. Because going to see, is it Khufu's solar bark?
Yeah.
I think it was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen.
Stunning.
And the most weird thing. I couldn't get my head around, and I hadn't got a sense. I was like, what is this boat doing in the middle of the desert? Has it ever been to the sea? I hadn't really got this sense because I suppose having seen Viking ships and things like that, I thought, well, it's a vessel that's actually made to go in the water.
Yeah.
So there's something in it, and I suppose we haven't really brought in the boat, so it just keeps feeling like it's knocking on the door for me.
Okay, I can talk a bit about that, because that's an important thing. One of the things that, just as a very quick, too quick an answer, but I'll give you a quick answer. One of the things about that whole territory running up to the Great Pyramid is there were huge canals and things running up to it. So it looks like it's in the middle of the desert now. It was by the Sphinx, the temple by the Sphinx, which is the mortuary temple of Khufu, had canals joining it to the Nile, and so that and of course the boat there is ceremonially buried in the earth and kind of, but it's the same boats that were up and down the Nile. So it's not just a symbolic object. That boat would have been of the same design as an actual ceremonial boat, and very often, particularly in those days, the site of government was in Memphis, which is where the Great Pyramid is. Yeah, but they would periodically make pilgrimages by boat up to Abydos. and then further up to Luxor. So actually that's a, it's an amazing boat, but it's actually a literal boat. I mean, it's a, you know, it's not just a symbolic artifact.
Ah, right. I mean, there's something just amazing thinking about this boat that was in under the earth.
Yeah.
I suppose before it was excavated, and just thinking about the Bark of Ra actually going under the earth for 12 hours, literally going into the earth. And it just feels like, well, God, there's a boat that's in the earth, under the earth, buried. I don't know, it's kind of...
Well, if you think of the image of the duet, because what they're doing there is they're putting the boat into the duet. And if you think of that image in the middle register, there is... So you've got the two backs, so you've got the underworld Nile. Right, so it's going, so the, in a sense, the waters, everything goes underground. The boat follows the waters and follows the, it's going all the time along the waters in the middle of the two banks. So the three registers of the Book of Gates are the two banks of the underworld Nile that is traveling on all the time. Right, so that's why there's three registers. The middle register where the boat is the underworld Nile, which is carrying it, and so it comes up eventually to join the Nile, to join the Milky Way. Right, so the sun, in their imagination, it comes up, is born, and then travels across the sky, across the river of the Milky Way, which is echoed on Earth by the River of Nile, and then comes back again, then sinks down into the underneath river in the Duat.
That's amazing.
Yes, it's good in them.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else is burning before we finish? Okay, good. So no special preparations. Actually, it's the act of emergence is an act of relaxation. The only thing that just have a think about if there's anything that we've covered or not, or that you're not clear about, or you want to revisit or ask about. There's still time to do that. Yes, I was going to go on to say, in the last weekend, what I'm going to do is go right back to the beginning and look at the whole schema of the Book of Gates. So that just to remind us, I've done it a bit in the meditation this morning, and so the, but I'm going to kind of do it in a more kind of, you know, conscious way in the final weekend, really.
Lovely.
Okie dokie. It's good. So have a nice evening. See you all. See you all. See you all tomorrow. Okay. Bye bye, guys. Bye bye.